The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired and will be available in podcast after the broadcast. I'm Jackie Roble for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Welcome to Halloween Horror Half Hour. I have a few Halloween stories for you. I hope you enjoy them and they're not too scary. Where the Meat Comes From by Joshua Flowers. The butcher came down the hall wearing his blood-soaked apron, reeking of pain and death. He had a rough beard that was hard and jagged against the hand. He had long, greasy hair that gave an odd shine off of the dim lights of the hallway, although that may just be because of how dirty the lights were. The hallway was either lit in a dirty piss-colored light or covered in a miasma of darkness. The only thing pristine there was the butcher's cleaver. It was cleaned and polished to a shine, its blade carefully manicured so it could easily cut paper in one motion. The butcher gripped it with his strong, calloused hand. In the other hand was a bucket filled with blood, swaying as he walked. Little bits fell out and splashed over the previous stains, keeping the coat on the floor fresh. Eventually the butcher came to a door at the end of the long hallway. It was made of an old and rotting wood, and he worried about it falling apart and what would happen if it got out. He knocked twice to let it know he was coming in. Not that it mattered. It always reacted the same way. Stupid thing. He twisted the knob and let the door gently swing inward. The room was filled with blackness, and in the middle was a small yellow dot floating at about knee height. It bobbed up and down with a heavy breathing. "Tom?" the butcher said calmly, waiting for a response. But like always, there was nothing. He sighed and flipped on the light, bracing himself for the noise. As soon as the light came on, the screaming started. This horrible eardrum bursting wail erupted from a pale creature rolling around in the middle of the room. Its skin was white, almost translucent, as you could see all of its many veins. It was naked and bald all over. You couldn't see the face as its long, bony fingers with overgrown nails covered it, but you could see the scars. All over its torso were these white lines and dark spots from happier times, like the spots and odd colorings of a cat. The butcher ignored the thing rolling around in agony and instead focused his attention on the wall, where chains were hanging up the meat, all naked and wide-eyed, either staring at the creature or the man in the doorway. He eyed each of them one by one. There was a blonde, her long hair a tangled and frizzy mess, with large fat breasts. But they may have been fakes, as they did not seem proportionate to her very slim, almost starved figure. There was a man, maybe in his late 40s or 50s. His body wasn't as lean as the woman. He was much chubbier and hairier, with gray patches on his chest and armpits. The thing could only get what it finds in the night, so the butcher couldn't be too picky. The next was another woman, young like the blonde. It had a preference for grabbing young women, who was so perplexed by the thing in front of her she could not look away. Finally, there was the Asian. He had been there the longest, and instead of looking at the screaming thing, he just stared at the butcher with a gaze of more hatred than fear. "Yes," thought the butcher, "it's about time." He turned out the light, and just like that, the screaming stopped, replaced with a deep panting as it tried to recover. "The one on the far right," the butcher said loudly, and he listened to the soft, almost non-existent sound of movement. Next thing the butcher heard was the combination of chains rattling and the sound of liquid hitting the floor, each creating its own echo, resulting in a mess of splats. Then a body was tossed into the small path of light created from the hallway. The butcher dropped the bucket and grabbed the corpse's bruised wrist and dragged it out of the room. When it was out, he slid the bucket inside and shut the door. Then there was the sound of liquid spilling everywhere, then choking, and lastly licking. First the crinkling sound against the metal, then the rough, ripping sound against stone. When it was done, there was a thump against the door, followed by a faint, raspy whisper. "Thank you, Daddy." But the butcher didn't hear. He was already up in his shop, preparing the meat for the next lunch. Embarcadero by Tony Bowman. Talbot closed his eyes and felt the smooth wood of the bar under his palms. He could hear conversations going on around him. Mundane things. Everyday things. He could hear the clink of the glasses as Bill the bartender moved up and down the bar, filling glasses. Beside him, he could smell her perfume. It was July 10th, 7:05 p.m. in the Cast-Off Bar, Pier 39, San Francisco.
"Do you believe in ghosts?" he asked her.
She was there, curly brown hair cascading down her shoulders, short red dress, red nails. She smiled, laugh lines crinkling beside her eyes.
"Now that's an original line," she said and tapped the glass of her gin and tonic with a long red nail. "Thanks," Talbot said.
He turned on his bar stool and looked at her. She was captivating, always captivating.
"You didn't answer my question, though."
"Ghosts? I don't know. Maybe."
"Do you?" "Do I what?"
"Believe in ghosts."
"Oh, yes,"
he said and laughed.
"What do you do?"
She finished her gin and tonic. "I teach third grade. What about you?"
Well, I guess you could say I'm a real estate negotiator," he said.
He noticed the bartender was walking down the bar toward them. Talbot pointed to her glass.
"Would you like another drink?"
The bartender reached them and the woman looked up.
"I'll have a tequila sunrise," Talbot said.
The bartender stared at her as she stared at Talbot. "Yes, how did you know I wanted a tequila sunrise?" The bartender turned and began mixing the drink.
"I'm psychic,"
Talbot said and smiled his tired smile.
"A psychic real estate negotiator. By the way, what is a real estate negotiator?"
she asked.
"Development companies hire me to negotiate land deals. You know, talk people into selling their house, moving, that sort of thing,"
Talbot said. He looked at the clock on the wall. 7:09.
"That's a sad job," she said as the bartender delivered her tequila sunrise.
"Aren't you drinking?" she asked.
"Oh, I don't drink," he said. "And my job's not really sad. Most people are happy to move on."
"You're kidding," she said.
"No, no, they're quite content."
"No, I mean about the not drinking. Why on earth are you sitting at a bar if you don't drink?" she asked. She sipped the sunrise, beads of moisture sliding along the glass, along her nails.
"Well, I'm talking to you," he said and smiled.
"Oh, I see. So you're here in this bar trying to pick me up," she said, her smile much wider and less tired than his own. He looked wounded.
"Is it a crime to want to have a conversation with a beautiful woman?"
She blushed and looked down at the bar. "I haven't been called that in a long time. Mr.
Oh, I'm sorry. Richard Talbot," he said and held out his hand.
"Pam Cole," she said, and took his hand. "Mr. Talbot."
"Richard, please."
"Richard. Can I ask you a question?"
"Certainly."
"You're not a homicidal maniac who stalks middle-aged women in bars, are you?"
"Absolutely not," he said, smiling.
"Then you can stop trying so hard. You had me at hello," she said and squeezed his hand. "It's funny, I feel like I've known you forever." It was Talbot's turn to blush.
"I know how you feel."
She opened her purse and dropped some bills on the bar. "Want to get out of here?" Talbot looked at the clock. 7:17.
"Can we stay here just a few more minutes?"
She looked at him, her eyes sparkling, a slow grin spreading across her face. "You are interesting, but I really need some air. It's a beautiful evening. I want to walk." They held hands and walked out of the bar and onto the long concrete embarcadero. Concrete piers jutted out into the bay, some with cruise ship moored alongside. They walked, their backs to the warm sun, her heels clicking on the concrete. He looked at his watch occasionally. She stopped in front of Pier 33. The cruise ship Sea Harvest was moored alongside. She stood in front of Talbot, wrapped her arms around his neck, and looked up into his eyes. "My apartment is 2 blocks up Francisco Street." Talbot sighed. He looked into her smiling eyes. His eyes were tired, pained.
"It's 7:27 p.m., July 10th, Talbot said. "Just up the hill, in the top of Koi Tower, 3 terrorists have planted a suitcase-sized nuclear device. 30 seconds from now, it's going to go off. 800,000 people are going to die. The fallout will kill even more."
Shaking her head, she took a step back from him.
Why do I always attract the nuts? Pam, listen to me. You're stuck here. Your ghost is stuck reliving the last half hour of your life. You've been replaying the scene for hundreds of years. Please, you don't have to stay here. You can go on. Trust me, Talbot pleaded. She was backing up, backing toward the concrete wall of the pier building. She started to say something and then stared over his shoulder at the white edifice of the Koi Tower. Talbot closed his eyes. He felt the heat, felt the wind at his back. Talbot! Keegan asked. Talbot opened his eyes. He was standing on the ruins of the Embarcadero. The great blasted and rusting hulk of the cruise ship Sea Harvest bobbed alongside the ruined pier. The outline of a woman had been burned into the white, crumbling wall by a blast that happened 500 years before. Talbot! Keegan repeated. I'm all right, he said, and collapsed onto the cracked concrete. He stared at the shadow of Pam Cole. Did it work? No. Perhaps you should try a different ghost. There's so many more we need to get rid of, Keegan said. The ruins of San Francisco were free of radiation now, but the ghosts made it problematic. No, she's the only one who'll talk to me. Talbot closed his eyes and felt the smooth wood of the bar under his palms. He could hear conversations going on around him. Mundane things. Everyday things. He could hear the clink of the glass as Bill, the bartender, moved up and down the bar, filling drinks. Beside him, he could smell her perfume. The Telltale Heart by Edgar Allan Poe. True, nervous, very, very dreadfully nervous I had been and am. But why will you say that I am mad? The disease had sharpened my senses, not destroyed, not dulled them. Above all was the sense of hearing acute. I heard all things in the heaven and in the earth. I heard many things in hell. How then am I mad? Hearken, and observe how healthily, how calmly I can tell you the whole story. It is impossible to say how first the idea entered my brain. But once conceived, it haunted me day and night. Object there was none. Passion there was none. I loved the old man. He had never wronged me. He had never given me insult. For his gold I had no desire. I think it was his eye. Yes, it was this. He had the eye of a vulture, a pale blue eye with a film over it. Whenever it fell upon me, my blood ran cold. And so by degrees, very gradually, I made up my mind to take the life of the old man, and thus rid myself of the eye forever. Now this is the point. You fancy me mad. Madmen know nothing. But you should have seen me. You should have seen how wisely I proceeded. With what caution! With what foresight! With what dissimulation I went to work! I was never kinder to the old man than during the whole week before I killed him. And every night, about midnight, I turned the latch of his door and opened it, oh, so gently. And then, when I had made an opening sufficient for my head, I put in a dark lantern, all closed, closed, that no light shone out, and then I thrust in my head. Oh, you would have laughed to see how cunningly I thrust it in. I moved it slowly, very, very slowly, so that I might not disturb the old man's sleep. It took me an hour to place my whole head within the opening so far that I could see him as he lay upon his bed. Ha! Would a madman have been so wise as this? And then when my head was well in the room, I undid the lantern cautiously, oh, so cautiously, cautiously, for the hinges creaked. I undid it just so much that a single thin ray fell upon the vulture eye. And this I did for 7 long nights, every night just at midnight, but I found the eye always closed. And so it was impossible to do the work, for it was not the old man who vexed me, but his evil eye. And every morning, when the day broke, I went boldly into the chamber and spoke courageously to him, calling him by name in a hearty tone and inquiring how he passed the night. So you see, he would have been a very profound old man indeed to suspect that every night, just at 12, I looked in upon him while he slept. Upon the 8th night I was more than usually cautious in opening the door. A watch's minute-hand moves were quicker than mine.
Never before that night had I felt the extent of my own powers, of my own sagacity. I could scarcely contain my feelings of triumph. To think that there I was, opening the door, little by little, and me not even dream of my secret deeds or thoughts. I fairly chuckled at the idea. And perhaps he heard me, for he moved on the bed suddenly, as if startled. Now you may think that I drew back, but no. His room was as black as pitch with a thick darkness, for the shutters were closed fast through fear of robbers, and so I knew that he could not see the opening of the door, and I kept pushing it on steadily, steadily. I had my head in and was about to open the lantern, when my thumb slipped upon the tin fastening, and the old man sprang up in bed, crying out, "Who's there?" I kept quite still and said nothing. For a whole hour I did not move a muscle, and in the meantime I did not hear him lie down. He was still sitting up in the bed listening, just as I have done, night after night, hearkening to the death watches in the wall. Presently I heard a slight groan, and I knew it was the groan of mortal terror. It was not a groan of pain or of grief. Oh, no! It was the low, stifled sound that arises from the bottom of the soul when overcharged with awe. I knew the sound well. Many a night, just at midnight, when all the world slept, it has welled up from my own bosom, deepening, with its dreadful echo, the terrors that distracted me. I knew that he had been lying awake ever since the first slight noise, when he had turned in the bed. His fears had been ever since growing upon him. He had been trying to fancy them causeless, but could not. He had been saying to himself, "It is nothing but the wind in the chimney. It is only a mouse crossing the floor," or, "It is merely a cricket which has made a single chirp." Yes, he had been trying to comfort himself with these suppositions, but he had found all in vain. All in vain? Because death, in approaching him, had stalked with his black shadow before him and enveloped the victim, and it was the mournful influence of the unperceived shadow that caused him to feel, although he neither saw nor heard, to feel the presence of my head within the room. When I had waited a long time, very patiently, without hearing him lie down, I resolved to open a little, a very, very little crevice in the lantern. So I opened it. You cannot imagine how stealthily, stealthily, until at length a simple dim ray, like the thread of the spider, shot out from the crevice and fell upon the vulture eye. It was wide open, wide, wide open, and I grew furious as I gazed upon it. I saw it with perfect distinctness, all a dull blue, with a hideous veil over it that chilled the very marrow in my bones. But I could see nothing else of the old man's face or person, for I had directed the ray as if by instinct, precisely upon the damned spot. And have I not told you that what you mistake for madness is but over-acuteness of the sense? Now, I say, there came to my ears a low, dull, quick sound, such as a watch makes when enveloped in cotton. I knew that sound well, too. It was the beating of the old man's heart. It increased my fury, as the beating of a drum stimulates the soldier into courage. But even yet I refrained and kept still. I scarcely breathed. I held the lantern motionless. I tried how steadily I could maintain the ray upon the eve. Meantime, the hellish tattoo of the heart increased. It grew quicker and quicker, and louder every instant. The old man's terror must have been extreme. It grew louder, I say, louder every moment. Do you mark me well? I have told you that I am nervous. So I am. And now, at the dead hour of the night, amid the dreadful silence of that old house, so strange a noise as this excited me to uncontrollable terror. Yet for some minutes longer, I refrained and stood still. But the beating grew louder, louder. I thought the heart must burst. And now a new anxiety seized me. The sound would be heard by a neighbor. The old man's hour had come. With a loud yell, I threw open the lantern and leaped into the room. He shrieked once, once only. In an instant I dragged him to the floor and pulled the heavy bed over him. I then smiled gaily to find the deed so far done. But for many minutes the heart beat on with a muffled sound. This, however, did not vex me. It would not be heard through the wall. At length it ceased. The old man was dead. I removed the bed and examined the corpse.
Yes, he was stone, stone dead. I placed my hand upon the heart and held it there many minutes. There was no pulsation. He was stone dead. His eye would trouble me no more. If you still think me mad, you will think so no longer when I describe the wise precautions I took for the concealment of the body. The night waned, and I worked hastily, but in silence. First of all, I dismembered the corpse. I cut off the head and the arms and the legs. I then took up three planks from the flooring of the chamber and deposited all between the scantlings. I then replaced the board so cleverly, so cunningly, that no human eye, not even his, could have detected anything wrong. There was nothing to wash out, no stain of any kind, no blood spot whatever. I'd been too wary for that. A tub had caught all. Ha ha! When I made an end of these labors, it was 4 o'clock, still dark as midnight. As the bell sounded the hour, there came a knocking at the street door. I went down to open it with a light heart, for what had I had now to fear? There entered 3 men, who introduced themselves, with perfect suavity, as officers of the police. A shriek had been heard by a neighbor during the night. Suspicion of foul play had been aroused. Information had been lodged at the police office, and they, the officers, had been deputed to search the premises. I smiled. For what had I to fear? I bade the gentlemen welcome. The shriek, I said, was my own in a dream. The old man, I mentioned, was absent in the country. I took my visitors all over the house. I bade them search, search well. I led them, at length, to his chamber. I showed them his treasures, secure, undisturbed. In the enthusiasm of my confidence, I brought chairs into the room and desired them here to rest from their fatigues, while I myself, in the wild audacity of my perfect triumph, placed my own seat upon the very spot beneath which reposed the corpse of the victim. The officers were satisfied. My manner had convinced them. I was singularly at ease. They sat, and while I answered cheerily, they chatted of familiar things. But ere long, I felt myself getting pale and wished them gone. My head ached, and I fancied a ringing in my ears. But still they sat and chatted. The ringing became more distinct. It continued and became more distinct. I talked more freely to get rid of the feeling, but it continued and gained definiteness, until at length I found that the noise was not within my ears. No doubt I now grew very pale, but I talked more fluently and with a heightened voice. Yet the sound increased, and what could I do? It was a low, dull, quick sound, much such a sound as a watch makes when enveloped in cotton. I gasped for breath, and yet the officers heard it not. I talked more quickly, more vehemently, but the noise steadily increased. I rose and argued about trifles in a high key and with violent gesticulations, but the noise steadily increased. Why would they not be gone? I paced the floor to and fro with heavy strides, as if excited to fury by the observations of the men, but the noise steadily increased. Oh, God, what could I do? I foamed, I raved, I swore. I swung the chair upon which I had been sitting and grated it upon the boards, but the noise arose over all and continually increased. It grew louder, 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 and still the men chatted pleasantly and smiled. Was it possible they heard not? Almighty God, no, no, they heard, they suspected, they knew. They were making a mockery of my horror. This I thought, and this I think. But anything was better than this agony, anything was more tolerable than this derision. I could bear those hypocritical smiles no longer. I felt that I must scream or die, and now again, hark! Louder, 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 and louder. Villains, I shrieked, dissemble no more. I admit the deed. Tear up the planks. Here, here. It is the beating of this hideous heart.
Me Ty Doty Walker by Alvin Schwartz. There was a haunted house where every night a bloody head fell down the chimney. At least, that's what people said. So nobody would stay there overnight. Then a rich man offered $200 to whoever would do it.
and this boy said he would try if he could have his dog with him. So it was all settled. The very next night, the boy went to the house with his dog. To make it more cheerful, he started a fire in the fireplace. Then he sat in front of the fire and waited, and his dog waited with him. For a while, nothing happened. But a little after midnight, he heard someone singing softly and sadly, off in the woods. The singing sounded something like this. Well, it's just somebody singing, the boy told himself, but he was frightened. Then his dog answered the song. Softly and sadly it sang, Linchi, kinchi, kali, mali, dingo, dingo. The boy could not believe his ears. His dog had never uttered a word before. Then, a few minutes later, he heard the singing again. Now it was closer and louder, but the words were the same. This time the boy tried to stop his dog from answering. He was afraid that whoever was singing would hear it and come after them. But his dog paid no attention, and again it sang, Linchi, kinchi, kali, mali, dingo, dingo. A half hour later, the boy heard the singing again. Now it was in the backyard, and the song was the same. Me-tie-do-tie-walker. Again, the boy tried to quiet his dog, but the dog sang out louder than ever, Linchi, kinchi, kali, mali, dingo, dingo. Soon, the boy heard the singing again. Now it was coming down the chimney. Me-tie-do-tie-walker. The dog sang right back, Linchi, kinchi, kali, mali, dingo, dingo. Suddenly, a bloody head fell out of the chimney. It missed the fire and landed right next to the dog. The dog took one look and fell over, dead from fright. The head turned and stared at the boy. Slowly, it opened its mouth and... Halloween Horror Half Hour. If you like the stories, please point your friends to the podcast on our webpage, www.trianglereadingservice.org. Just click the Directory of All Podcasts link and go to the Halloween folder. If you have any comments or suggestions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. If we get some good feedback, perhaps we won't have to wait till next Halloween for more scary stories. Until then, I'm Jackie Roble for the Triangle Radio Reading Service, wishing you pleasant dreams.